Okay, Kath, would you like to take a seat, please? And I'd like to invite back to the stage Sean, Ignatius and Warwick. If you're wondering why Nick's here, not here, it's not any sort of personal snub. It's just a number of chairs and so on. But we'll, Nick will wave at us if he's got something to say. It's one microphone between two. I'd ask you to speak into the microphone so we can record every word. And similarly on the floor, please walk up to a microphone if you'd like to comment. My thoughts of this suggestion is we're amongst friends. I'm just happy to let the discussion sort of ebb and flow as you wish. Feel free to take us in any direction you want. There's 100 directions to go in. I'll if that doesn't work, I've got some questions, but let's go. It's an open house. Ask anything you like, and we'll do our best. Rob, thank you.
Sean, it's a question for you. You commented that PHI was 10% of total healthcare, but of course it's a far higher percentage of the relevant services because... out-of-hospital medical and pharmaceutical are effectively out of scope for us. Given that the industry does play a substantial part in the funding of those relevant services, it has concerned me for a while, and I have said this to you several times before, obviously, that I feel that PHI is an orphan in Canberra and doesn't really have... anyone who understands or bats for PHI, perhaps with the exception of FIAC. So do you have any comments on that? And it goes directly to what Kath said there just a second ago about alignment.
Okay, we're off the record or not? This is a transcript, isn't it? So I... look, I'll say more or less the same thing anyway, but I just... private health insurance is one of those areas that is mostly off the radar unless it's on it, if you know what I mean. And when it's on it, it's really on it. It has, I think you're mostly talking about the Department of Health when you're making that observation, Rob. And obviously the broader... Well, okay, I'll come to the politicians as a separate case. In terms of the bureaucratic elements, though, first. The rest of the government is not terribly focused on it. Basically, the people who take an interest in private health insurance are the Department of Finance, which does so because of the cost of revenue associated with the rebate. That obviously flows through into Treasury, but they generally see it through the lens of dollars, Commonwealth money, taxpayers' money being spent on what is essentially a form of industry assistance in their analysis. The Department of Finance also has a particular interest by reason of being the shareholder of Medibank Private, so that's another dimension of interest. And I wouldn't, you know, overlook that too quickly either, particularly given if there's a change of government, the question of the privatisation of Medibank Private sort of re-emerges as a, you know, fairly likely event. And then, of course, the true home of private health insurance policy, which is the department. And in the department, there's a branch dedicated to private health insurance. It sits, like a lot of areas, within, you know, a sort of bureaucratic structure that has ultimately other things, other streams come in and intersect and play their role as well. Private health insurance, I think, does tend to sort of be a little bit to the side. I would agree with that. I mean, the dominating focus of interest in the department is the public sector and the public health system. That's where unquestionably the vast amount of dollars are being spent. And it's also, and this is a key driver of activity in the bureaucratic domain, is the that's the point of interface with state governments as well. So that generates a whole lot of its own activity. So the private health insurance industry isn't sort of structurally in the middle of a lot of the government activity by reason of that. Policy comes out of the department. There are there are, I think it sort of comes up and then goes down. We had a period of intense policy activity around private health insurance at the time of the 2007 legislation. And those of you around at that time would know that it was, you know, there was a lot of time and energy devoted to getting that new legislation in place. And I think, you know, once that was over the line, the new legislation was in place, and shortly afterwards a new government came in as well, there was a certain amount of just, okay, let's relax, we've done that for a little while. 6 or 7 years in the life of a government is not a very long time. So I don't think when you look at those sort of timelines that you could say that private health insurance is, you know, completely in the back room, you know, sort of as a despised and forgotten area, far from it. But it does have this tendency to erupt, and that really brings me into the political domain where the industry is very prominent. It lobbies strongly, visibly. It has numbers of champions. Whenever a policy or a legislative proposal is put through, there is no end of people who are prepared to speak on those issues. Some of the longest contributors by backbenchers are around private health insurance issues. I know the other day the Leader of the Opposition referred to private health insurance as something that was in the marrow of the bones of the coalition. So that obviously is pretty core to their mission. So it's, you know, it's very much jostling along with many other important issues for its place in the sun. I think it's definitely there. I wouldn't characterise it as an orphan in that sense, but I think it has this kind of, you know, a bit of a surging quality to it. It comes up, gets really sort of focused on and the centre of attention then sort of abates a bit. And, you know, obviously while the industry is in good shape and people are joining, you know, a lot of the indicators at the moment are in the right direction, that does tend to diffuse the level of particular sort of media and broader political focus when there are other things that are obviously competing for that space.
Anyone else on the panel want to comment on that, or Rob, you can come back, or someone else can take us somewhere else. Brent.
I really intended to sit here and listen all day and not get up. But there's a little bit of a thread here I want to explore. In my view, and given that I was quite largely responsible for a lot of these things that happened, setting up a FEAC and stuff, the reason for FEAC's existence was to try and depoliticise private health insurance. And the alignment that we should be seeking is to keep it out of the political radar as much as possible. That's the best way of running this industry. Now, I'm just interested in what the panel have to say about that.
It's my other favourite subject is politics. There are certain things that we wish for, like depoliticising a lot of things that lead to short-termism, lead to really short-term decisions that are not in the long-term interest of the economy, most of which you will not be amazed to know are not being debated, even though we are only weeks out from an election. As much as we would want private health insurance to be depoliticised, I can honestly say it's a pipe dream. We are just never going to get there while there's a connection, particularly between taxation, rebates, and our members and the premiums they pay. So while they've got skin in the game, I just think that it's impossible for us to take it out of the hands of government unless we were actually prepared to be completely deregulated and therefore not have MLS, not have sticks that make people join up, nor have carrots, be it rebates or otherwise, to ask people or encourage them to join. And that's where the politics and the dollars meet, and the fact that you will never have finance and treasury and others not interested in this. Where I think it's interesting, and certainly since I've been in this industry, is the number of times where we have discussions around the money and rebates and MLS with Department of Health and Ageing. And when I first came in, I said, when's the last time we sat down and spoke to Treasury or Finance? And it was a very interesting discussion because they said, well, we don't. And I thought, well, you're engaging absolutely with the right area from the point of view of the objectives of delivering better health outcomes for the Australian people. I agree. But if you're talking about money and you're not talking to Treasury, then you have no idea what numbers are being presented to politicians. And if you don't know what's being presented to politicians, how do we align it? So from my perspective, we've also got to get our hands on the balance sheet and the P&L. And I was mortified when I came into this industry and found out that there's not a supply chain analysis. And I can't tell where the money's leaking from. I suspect I know. I think I went so far as actually to put in a submission, which was very silly of me knowing that they were public. But I do think we need a much better understanding of where the Treasury dollars are going in order to depoliticise it and the impact that it has on PHI.
Scott. Anyone else?
Yeah, I would have even said, even if you took all that away, don't worry about it anyway, because the health costs of the nation will always be a political issue. Like, the overall cost spent on health is such a large percentage of GDP. It's got to be a political issue. Where's the money going to come from as we get older and sicker and all that sort of thing? Why would any sensible government not have how do we fund this on the agenda? I think we suffer from the same thing that many other areas suffer in that, you know, we run from election cycle to election cycle. There's no long-term vision. There's no clear path of this is the way we're going to fund health costs into the future. We'll change the government or the government will get another election will come up and there'll be something else to talk about. And that's no different to infrastructure. It's no different to many other, you know, education. There's no vision anywhere. So, you know, we could continue talking about this forever, and I'd suggest we concentrate on things we've got something that we can change. But anyway.
I just want to contrast the Australian political system with the Singapore political system, because I spend a lot of time advising the Singapore government on their MediShield scheme, which is their national health insurance scheme. And so obviously Singapore has a very different political system, and it's actually quite a joy to work for a client where they do look out into the future, 50 years and 70 years, 80 years. Right now, we are trying to work out how to help them fund for old age health costs for people who are only 1 year old at the moment. So there is an alternative system. Obviously, that's not something you can just put into Australia very easily. But if I was to answer your question, Rob, which system I prefer, as an actuary, I find it more satisfying to work for a client where that system exists, where there's not as much political interference and, you know, the public, the civil service just goes about their job and genuinely is looking to find the right solutions for their population.
Well, I'm not deliberately, because FEAC is, as been pointed out by Brent, is a proudly apolitical and professional regulator, which doesn't buy into the political arguments. We have, I think, having said that, we have to acknowledge the quite sort of nuanced line that we've been taking recently in relation to our PACU work, which has been interesting. It's been really quite a lot of fun, and we sort of really do feel we're at the beginning of a long line of very, hopefully, very useful projects. But that, yeah, well, but you see, I think the line that I'm trying to sort of walk along, or at least not avoid crossing, is somehow or other losing sight of what we do best in that role, which is leverage our experience, draw upon a lot of data, a lot of good connections, and just some smart people, and produce a document which is going to elevate the conversation and improve the level of understanding around important issues in the industry. And then, having produced that, kind of hand it over to the people who then want to advocate a particular position. Now, that's what we're seeking to do. We want to produce useful information so there's an informed discussion. People actually start from a base of reliable data, not bullshit. And there's a lot of, unfortunately, there's too much of that being thrown around in the, well, all over the place, really. So I think we're hoping to sort of bring into the private health insurance space a lot more rational, sensible, evidence-based information, which is then going to be a stepping-off point, and people can run their arguments. I don't really care where they go after that, but at least I know they're starting from a better information base. That I think is a valuable role we can perform.
And Rob, you can nominate yourself for Parliament as all of us can. Yeah. So run as an independent in the next election. Follow Peter Carroll's example.
Yeah. Look, I'm happy to take more questions on the environment, or Andrew.
Yeah, I've got one for Sean and one for the panel. Sean, you've just recently you and the team have done a bit of a travel around the different health insurers and got some feedback on the regulations. I just wondered, could you share some of the trends and themes that come out and what struck you at those conversations you had with insurers and boards? And for the rest of the panel, given where we're at now, we've got through consultation and quiz, what anxieties do you have, or what leaves you anxious about the standards and preparing for them and where we're at today?
Sean first, I guess.
I'll start. Well, thanks for that question, Matthew, because it allows me to disclose a deeply held secret. That consultation round started around about the third week of June and ran through till about the end of July. For three of those weeks, I was in France. So I was actually not thinking about private health insurance at all. I was enjoying the delights of France and the Tour de France and a number of other things. So what I did do, I did actually, but I was, and you know this because the way it worked out was I spoke to some funds in WA before I left, and then I was away, and then at the end I spoke to Medibank Private, I spoke to Bupa, I spoke to HCF, so there were a number of big funds towards the end as well. And I think, you know, some of those were held back until I returned. So I can only really talk about those experiences. I know that the transaction, the communication was excellent, and that was right across the board. I think most people, we were focusing obviously on the standards. That was the reason for the meeting, so that tended to be the main topic of conversation. We found the whole thing very gratifying, very reassuring, you know, I think confirming of our strong commitment to the value of consultation. It was unusual for us, we haven't done this too many other times before, to actually consult in relation to a set of standards fund by fund. That's not how we normally do it. We normally, you know, get you all in a room and have a session for Sydney or whatever. But we felt that model of consultation didn't really work with those particular standards, because the generic discussion was over in 5 minutes, you know, and then it was down to the detail of particular insurers with their own particular investment profile, their own business approach, the issues that were sitting within individual insurers. And I think, you know, we didn't regret, even though it put a bit of pressure on the organisation to get around and talk to everyone like that. It was a extremely valuable experience. The general quality of the interaction was supportive, particularly of the capital adequacy test. A lot of people embraced the whole idea of the way the stress test has been designed and liked the idea, and particularly were, you know, could see how it could be really understood and grasped and worked through with boards, which was a key feature of our reason for doing it that way. More conversation around the technical application of aspects of the solvency standard, and you know, we've taken that away, and we're going to make a few more changes in that area. But broadly speaking, everybody I think was supportive of the idea that it was time to rethink the approach to provisioning for risk through the through these prudential standards. And we had enormously good feedback, and it was a very, very positive process so far. And you know, we're going to actually make the standard at the September meeting. Our intention is to just get it out for one last final consultation, but we're really virtually in the final stages now.
And the follow-up question was, I think it was aspects of the new standard that people are thinking about.
Some of them I already put up on the slide when it comes to mine, but I think what concerns me most is that what I observe is that there are a number of people that seem to... Gosh, I'm going to be really contentious. There are a number of things that I hear that would suggest that we're playing around the edges a lot with some of the fundamental principles of PHI, and that, to me, either means that we don't believe in the current model of private... health insurance, in which case let's have that open and honest discussion and change the model. What concerns me is what will happen is that playing around the edges will lead to rule changes, which will be evidence-based rule changes. They will literally look at bad behaviour and say, because some funds are doing this, we need to tighten the rules. And I can give you examples around risk equalisation. I can give examples around community rating, exclusionary products. What I see in terms of intermediaries, in my bio it mentioned that I was on the Accounting Professional Ethical Standards Board. Why, when you have FOFA come out, which clearly deals with conflicted remuneration, and yet in an industry that this is relatively new to, you would allow unregulated entities to be driving certain behaviours in an industry. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff, to be quite honest, that does keep me awake at night when it comes to this industry. And we can point to the politicians. As an industry, we can point to the politicians and say, where's the long-term plan? But equally, if I was a politician, I would be looking at this industry and I would be saying, where's the long-term plan? Because right now what I hear is a lot of funds with a lot of self-interest saying, we want risk equalisation. Well, of course you do, because you're getting net money out of it. Well, we don't want risk equalisation. Well, of course we don't, because we're a net payer. But as soon as there's any discussion that's based on self-interest, playing around the edges, as an industry, you know, it's just a catastrophe waiting to happen. I just think that this is a really good industry with some really good people in it that won't let that catastrophe happen, right? Well, okay, that's an observation. I've only been here 2 years, so maybe I'm being naive. But I don't think I am, because at least people in this industry are prepared to have that conversation and walk into a discussion saying, I'm telling you, I've got self-interest here. I can tell you why our company has this position. And I think while you're still having that open and honest conversation, you've got a great industry. But if we don't have a long-term plan, I don't think it's fair that we should expect Treasury, Doha, ministers to have a long-term plan either.
Anyone else on that one, or will we go to Stuart?
I'm not sure if it's exactly the same as that one, but Andrew asked about what you found in the visits around the capital standard, so I'm moving on to stress test. Okay. Nick and Ignatius put up quite a few questions and variations and issues around the stress test. And if I stand back from those and start with perhaps a personal comment, it feels to me like at the moment the level of capital you declare to the regulator under the new stress tests is in quite a large degree voluntary. You can name any margin you like and defend it within a very wide range, not within a very narrow range at the moment. And that's because we're only partway through. If you look at Kath's concept of alignment, business practice and regulation, there's an important part of it that happens when the regulation is being shaped. But then there's also a really important part of it that happens after the regulation has been fixed and people know what they're dealing with, but then they have to bring the business practices into line, and there is a stick at the end of it, because FIAC can actually say that's not what we had in mind, but that's really a stick at the end of it. So we've had a process at the moment which is reasonably good. We've had consultation first round, people put the numbers in. We've had a second round, and now people have put the numbers in. We should get those numbers shared back with us and some observations back from FIAC who have the information. But in whatever it is now, it's 38 days or something, isn't it? End of September, it's now going to be a standard. And I think it's a question for all the people in the room now. The FIAC's role in owning this process in a large way stops on the day they make the rule, and the industry's role to pick up Kath's alignment concept really takes over. And on this particular issue, when we say the industry, it's effectively the people in this room. So that's the kind of context, right? It starts with the observations Ignatius and Nick made based on their surveys, goes through some of the things we've heard today, but then it ends up, how are we in the room going to manage the process from here of aligning, right? We need some particular things. I think we need some really good information sharing from FIAC, because there's no single person in this room who can see what everyone is doing except the people in FIAC. We need some sharing and debate inside the profession, which tests different approaches to things, and in that part of the process, we need to be careful not to trip ourselves up with the tension we have between competitive IP, right? I know how to do my way of doing stochastic modelling and I don't want to really share it with other people or whatever. Competitive IP versus we're a profession, I hold every man a debtor to his profession, we need actually, as a group ourselves, to sort out what is right. So I'd like the panel from, and I've given many different ways into this, but the basic question is, as a panel, what kind of a process do you think we should be adopting from here so that we don't end up where we are in this kind of interim role where the amount of regulatory capital you declare to the regulator you need is voluntary?
Thanks, Stuart. So the discussion's moved on to some of the practicalities around the new standards, which touches on Nick and Ignatius's presentation, in particular around information sharing and approach, and I'd like some perspectives from the panel on that, but also perhaps others could come in after that on what information should we share, what information should FIAC share, should there be industry guidance standards and comments to that. So perhaps if I could ask for the panel's comments first and then comments from the floor on that topic.
Can I, before the, just a couple of points. I mean, FIAC has been and will continue to share a lot of information around this, and obviously as the process plays out, we'll have that unique position that Stuart's described of being able to see all the various elements coming together, and we want to sort of feed that back in a way that's constructive. The other thing I haven't mentioned yet, and I should have by now, and I apologise for doing so, is that we think that the risk equaliser, sorry, that the capital adequacy and solvency standard new standards, is ripe for a what we call a SOP, a Standard Operating Procedure document. We've been issuing these in other areas of our work, particularly in the in the areas in which we issue directions and appoint administrators and various other functions. But it is essentially a, the concept between an S, the concept sitting behind a SOP is applicable here. It's about giving people a sense of how FEAC will exercise its discretionary judgments in relation to the discharge of its functions. And this is one of those areas. And I think, in addition to that close, tight communication loop, we need to and we will make a more formal pronouncement which people can look at and will help them, where we talk about how we want key judgments or how we expect key judgments under the standard to be. It'll probably take a little while. The standard comes in, starts at the September meeting or maybe shortly afterwards. The actual commencement date is still a little bit up for grabs. We're looking at the 31st of March or the 1st of April, or maybe it might go out to June. I've said in another fora that the timing, in a sense, is not the key issue, because it's not like anybody's going to have to rush off and raise capital. There's plenty of it around. It's mostly about getting the settings right, and getting it right is more important than some sort of particular addiction to a timing. One thought at the moment is that perhaps the standard might commence on the 31st of March, in other words, for the 1st of April, the new premium year, whatever that means, and sort of roll forward from there with maybe some provision for the capital management plan component to be sort of fleshed out and completed in time for, say, the 1st of July. So there's a number of kind of stepping phases. Now, with all that happening, the SOP, I don't think, would be able to be prepared until the standard is actually up and running. So I think it's probably a project for the second half of next year, is roughly around the time frame I'm looking at the moment.
Stuart, I think there is quite a bit that can be done to develop a standard of practice. I think the graph actually that Sean showed in his presentation of the variability of the net margin by size of fund is probably a good place to start. And if FEAC go through the same process that we recently went through with Hayden providing and Matthew providing feedback around the FCRs, what was good, what was not, what compared well to what they saw elsewhere in the industry, what fell short, whereabouts it should go, would help with that understanding of where you might fall on that chart and whether FEAC was comfortable or not. I can actually see, again, sitting from the position of advising health.com.au, where they have a unique set of risks compared to many in the industry. One size is not going to fit all. Certainly, we were one of the funds when we did our stress test that was really keenly focused on the variability of the contribution income, because that was going to affect the variability of our net margin more than it would affect a HCR for a Medibank or whatnot. Growing so fast, where you get to will have a big impact on your expense margin. So it was important to us. That might not be so important to anyone else. But I think if we get that understanding, in my view, that there could be a role for the Institute similar to what we've seen in the general insurance industry with the information note on the insurance concentration risk charge, where, again, it's a new regulatory requirement. It's a bit on the edge of where actuaries have participated to date. There's a wide range of practice, and what we've tried to do is say, look, here are a range of different things that would work in practice. It would be good for you to consider which one suits your fund best, but here are the things you should be thinking about, and here are some of the things you should be using as criteria for assessing which way to go. And then maybe over time that develops into a professional standard. But there's definitely, I know with the funds that I talk to, there's definitely a view that, yes, look, it is important that we get the answer that's right for us, but we don't want to be too far on the limb one way or another. We don't want to be holding miles too much capital than our competitors and putting one hand behind our back in terms of the pricing. But on the same note, we don't want to be miles under where we should be and putting our members and policyholders at risk to an insolvency where they shouldn't be doing that. So my experience is that the funds that we advise want to know that they're sitting close to the middle of the road, they're sitting in a month's industry practice. And I think there are things that we can do as a profession and in consultation with FEAC and getting the feedback around what's going on that we can help achieve that aim. So, you know, that would be my 2 cents worth.
Ignatius?
I guess just to add to that, it sounds like that if you ask the question, what information would we like from FEAC, you're going to get quite a different answer depending on which insurer you ask. So perhaps there's a role there for the Institute to, first of all, gather some information from all of the different insurers as to what information they would like to see, and perhaps find some way of prioritising what is actually the most important information to ask for.
Comments from the floor on information gathering, role for the Institute. Brent?
I sat there a little puzzled about Stuart's question. And I think you partially answered by saying this. You can't have one size fits all for capital standards. I mean, obviously we're going to do it differently. Different actuaries are going to do it differently, but also some of those differences, a lot of those differences are going to be dictated to by the size of the organisation. You've got a very small organisation. You can't spend, you can't go and do a Rolls-Royce job on them because they can't afford to pay you. Okay, so that's the first point. But I think that one of the most important parts of this exercise is change. I mean, once an actuary has set up a standard for that particular health fund and a way of doing things, you can't go and change it without justifying it and in pure actuarial terms, a sort of analysis of surplus, justifying why you've changed the standard and what that means. I mean, that becomes the part that the regulator should be most interested in. I mean, it's going to be nice to be in the middle of the road, but it's so much more important to make sure that there's consistency.
Can I just say, Brent, in terms of consistency, I agree with you, but I don't want people to feel that the once they've sort of set a particular level for their own assessment of this, particularly the assets test, that we, there's going to be some kind of ex post facto judgment passed on them if there's a revision or a sort of a second thinking process. We'd encourage people to do that. And also, obviously we want this to be a living kind of process, and we're asking boards to think about this about every quarter. We want them to look at not only the particular settings within the business, we're asking them to look at the broader economic environment, we're asking them to look at even, the sovereign international environment. There's a whole range of factors that factor into an assessment of risk, and, things in that setting should move around. And if the board changes the settings in relation to policies, or in particular way it's going to run its business, you'd expect something to move. And that, to me, is evidence of the system working. So I just want to... I'm not disagreeing with consistency. If nothing changes, then you'd expect it to stay the same. But I don't want to create a false sense of there being any kind of you know, sort of second-guessing or problem with people adjusting this, particularly as it's going through its, you know, initial period. It's like a batsman's average, you know. It sort of, you know, it bounces up and down for the first 10 innings and then, you know, over time it'll settle down. But, you know, that movement around for the first couple of years is going to be, I think, quite reasonable.
Can I just make one comment? I think a lot of the best practice and the consultation that you're looking for will not only come from the capital management standard, but from certain elements of it. So discussions around pricing philosophies and how those things might be worded and how we're going to have those discussions, not just the actuary, but CFOs and your product people, the people that are developing product, the people who are talking pricing and what it means from a competitive point of view. So I think that discussion, and certainly there are a number of discussion groups, certainly that I'm involved in, a regulatory working group, but also a CFO forum, where we... nowhere near crossing any lines on anti-competitive behaviour and things like that, but really just sharing intellectual property in an open and honest way and not an anti-competitive way. So that I'm encouraged by in this industry, and that's what I meant before, where we go into discussion groups, whether it's industry organised or funds, or where people are prepared to say, okay, but you need to understand the position I'm bringing to this table is my company's position, or, by the way, I'm expressing a personal opinion based on what I've observed. With that in mind, and I'm not going to ask this question, I'm just going to put it out there for anybody who might be interested in another idea, is as things like the risk management standard and the SOP are actually being produced, having a recognised regulatory working group or industry advisory group or whatever the case might be, I think I've seen that work very effectively with other regulators. I've seen it work very effectively for certain governments who've had business reporting advisory groups that they could actually call upon that were recognised in the industry as being able to speak, not for and on behalf of the industry, but at least with industry experience. And that actually allowed even the development of standards to operate that much more effectively. It was open. The participants, the people who are a part of those advisory groups, are well known. The times of the meetings and all the rest of it. And so, therefore, it became another safe way to have a conversation. So that's kind of what I've seen in other industries. And, you know, there are times where it doesn't break down, where it does break down, but it usually breaks down where there's a lack of trust in those who are sitting at the table. And the trust normally breaks down when there's a lack of transparency. So that's just an idea.
Is there any appetite for that sort of forum amongst actuaries, a sort of show and tell forum or through Nick? Or?
I think it would be interesting to try and couple up with the CFO forum for this industry. I think that would be really. And we have the umbrella that we can do it with the Institute here at the
Of course, Barry's sitting behind you saying, you know, the number of times that I'm at the CFO forum, not the CFO, because sometimes the content and all the rest of it, it's quite clear that this is a forum. So we do actually have a mix, but it's just an interesting one.
Peter.
I just want to... tease out a little bit more this issue of consistency, because I was particularly, I'm going to say something flattering about Sean again, and one of the things that I thought was particularly impressive in your presentation was your comment, which is unusual from regulators in my experience, that when you saw outliers in your spread of outcomes, you did not feel any particular need to push them back into a narrower band. And I thought that was a very, very insightful, if you like, view of this industry. And I noticed also when you published your report on competition recently and also many of the submissions on competition, there was a realisation apparent through all of that, the huge variety that there really is in what is quite, as you said, quite a small, intimate industry where you virtually know everybody's phone numbers and they all know you. But nevertheless, there's this huge variety. And I actually think that diversity and variety in this industry is one of its fundamental strengths. And if you look back to the original formation of the National Health Act, for example, back in 1953, Menzies and Page and the people that set it up, whatever your politics, that was the reason that they avoided the national health system approach in Europe, or the FDR approach to social welfare in the 1930s in USA, with one single monopoly all sort of run by one. They actually monopolised the aspects of it, community rating, product design and all of that, and various basic standards, but they allowed competition in the underwriting and the service provision. And that is, in my view, one of the reasons why still 50% of the population here buy the product. There is a huge variety. There is a huge, it's a bit like a federation as well. I lived in England. I lived in New Zealand, where there's one central government runs everything. Here in Australia, where there are states, you get this diversity and you get this competitive thrust. Now, when you talk about consistency, it's very useful, I think, for the actuaries to share information and to ask themselves the questions. But I think as soon as it morphs, if you like, into pressure for conformity and groupthink, another term that you used, which resonated with me, I think that is a mistake. So again, Sean, I think that the way in which the regulation of this industry is evolving, if that's really part of its culture, is to allow this diversity, in fact, to celebrate it, if you like, I think that's a very, very healthy thing. So I'm not one of these consistency freaks that wants everything to be easy and simple. And it is very easy for regulators just to have a flat benchmark, and if people don't fit with it, then, you know, there's pressure on them to conform. And it's very healthy, in my view, that that's not happening in this industry. Anyway, that's
my... Sounds like I better respond. Look, yes, I said all those things, and I do believe those things, but I think I need to just wind it back a little bit, because I don't think, you know, we want a free-for-all. We want something that's got inherent rigour, that's got clarity in the underlying principles. I agree. And, you know, I celebrate the diversity of this industry just as you do. Although I do feel that, you know, in some areas we've gone a bit far, actually, that it's becoming a bit confusing for consumers, and it's my consumer focus that's really drives that observation. But in terms of where people position on the in their assessment of the assets test and the provisioning for that, certainly in the early phases, I think we all need to kind of, you know, kick it around a bit and find out what feels right and test the theories. But I think over time there'll be a level of shared learning. I think I'm not for myself, you know, about absolute regimentation, but I do believe if somebody is well off the chart and in a space which is, you know, markedly different from anyone else in their sort of segment area, then, you know, we will be asking, obviously, what's the basis for this assessment? And, you know, you would expect it would be justified, there'd be some rational basis, but nevertheless, that's clearly an indicator for conversation. So it's... Well, yeah, maybe.
That's the other, you know, there's both sides to it.
Yeah.
So the question asking is good. The pressure for conformity.
Well, I mean, my point is I'm not starting from the position of saying that there has to be conformity. But what I do want is rigour. I want clarity, transparency, and something that demonstrates the basis for the difference. That to me is, you know, that's the evidence I'm after.
I'm reluctant to mention this one in case the regulator doesn't currently use this tool. But one of the things that that I've used before is, you know, for outliers and things like that, even within your organisation, you effectively do a risk profile and a risk appetite overlay. So you have your diagram which sets out where your pattern is and where the outliers are. And then you work out whether or not your outliers are within that risk appetite or if there's a specific risk profile reason. So it's a risk that you've already identified and are managing. So if you know, we use the example that you used before, growth, it's unusual, it is clearly an outlier. When that outlier matches the risk overlay that you put on top of it, so it says that's an outlier, this is what we thought the risk profile was, oh, look, they are sitting where we thought they were sitting. When you think that somebody has a low appetite for risk, where you believe that they've got a fairly safe, sound model, it's consistent and all the rest of it, but all of a sudden, whatever it might be, their returns, their growth, something, all of a sudden when you plot it, their risk profile doesn't match where they sit on that result. And we use it for investment returns. So when we're monitoring our investment advisor, we don't just look at the returns. We look at the returns compared to the standard deviations and the risk they should be taking. So it's a model that you can use in any organisation. And in actual fact, we used to use it for stakeholder management. It's one that I suggest that the sporting clubs use so that they actually overlay their risk appetite and their risk profile, would you believe, on all of the people within the organisation, their sponsors, their players, their, like, whatever it happens to be, so that they actually work out what risk profile, and if somebody or there's an outlier with a risk profile different to what they're used to, then they just put in place the risk mitigation strategy, or they say that's not a risk we're prepared to take, and therefore they take that risk out by taking the necessary decision. So it's an interesting framework. It's an interesting model that you can use in any environment.
Thanks, Kath. Okay, we'll make this the last one, please, Tori.
My question is to Sean. I mean, we talked about what information we can share. To me, is the history, we should not ignore the history. So the history is a good indication about what has happened in the past. And we talked about, you know, should we use our own fund, or should we use information from lifetime health cover period only or something. Rather than say what information we should be looking at, is it possible for FIRE to issue one table showing over the last 20 years the net margin variability year on year for every single fund? Every fund then has that, and whatever that does with it, it's up to them about their judgment that they can overlay. We talk about judgment, and judgment will always come into it. And to me, we need to communicate this to the board, and this is a very high level view. Is have a look at what happened in the last 20 years, and then you can add commentary to it. But that period we don't have that period now, and I would strongly debate whether you can say that anymore, because you know the periods year on year keep on changing. So is it possible just to get the one set of data, what each fund does with it, then it's up to them?
Stuart, can I just clarify, are you talking about a whole of industry number, or are you talking about, individual insurers?
I can go back.
Wouldn't they know that themselves?
Do a lot of work and find that out.
Yeah.
But is it possible that you can, you've got all that information.
Years worth of data.
Yes.
Where each insurer knows how it's performed over that period.
The industry knows how each insurer has performed.
And share it with the whole industry.
Yeah, but the information is published, has been published.
So it's a collation of your annual fund reports with over 20 years.
Okay.
So it includes the funds that disappear.
Yeah. Okay, sounds like a lot of work. I have to consult with my colleagues, because I'm not going to do it if we do it. And I'll get into trouble if I dob them in. Okay, if you persuade Matthew that it's a good idea, then you're well on your way, all right? But I'm not going to dob him in from the chair. But it sounds like a good idea, Tori. I don't think it's a bad idea, but I don't know whether it's easily compiled or not. But it would be, sounds like useful data.
Okay, I can take any more short comments, if there are any. Or... Governor.
This is
Sure. You asked about concerns. I have two concerns about the new standards. First of all, will premium round 2014 be required to be performed under those new capital standards, the projections for that?
2014 is
what will start next month.
Yes, yeah, yes, yes.
It will?
Yes.
In my opinion, it's a big ask to have that.
We understand that. It's a transitional thing, but yes, that's the new world, yeah.
The second concern is the relevant comparison, and this goes to Tori's question just a second ago, in my opinion, is the comparison between what an insurer projected in its premium round projections for the relevant year and the outcome for that year.
Yeah.
And that should be the difference that's being measured in that variability. That's what the work that I've done over the last 6 or 7 years has been about.
Well, maybe you should just mail each other your Excel spreadsheets. Sounds like 90% of it's been done anyway.
No, Sean, that's not a good answer, Sean, unfortunately.
Right? Well, I had to finish on a bad note. Anyway.
Because this is about something, it goes to Stuart's question about what we are measuring. And this is the measurement that determines whether an insurer fails or succeeds, whether it can do its premium round projections and get how close the answer is and what those sources of difference are. This is important, Sean, unfortunately.
Okay, thanks, Rob. Got it. I've noted it. I'll come back to you. I'm not able to give you an answer today.
No, it's in the submission.
Okay.
I think with that, if you could just join me in thanking all our panellists and Nick as well. I think you have to share one, Ignatius. Anyway, they're back. I won't hand them all out. Now, if you could just stay where you are, we do have a special announcement. Maybe Nick, if you could come up with that. Is Ben here? No. Okay, so in March 1998, when I guess some of us in this room were working in health insurance, but some of us certainly weren't. David Watson, technical manager of HCF, issued the first private health insurance newsletter. That document included information on regulatory circulars, parliamentary and government developments, adverts every so often, conference news, and links to relevant publications. First of all, it was just something David circulated to a few people, but word of this publication grew and grew, and today 1,800 people receive this newsletter, including over 350 people outside Australia, and that makes it the largest of any distribution list of any Actuaries Institute publication. And the readership comprises governments, regulators, industry practitioners, consultants to the health insurance industry, both here and abroad. Now, in 2004, so after 16 years and 133 editions, David handed over his baby to Ben Uwe, and then Ben handed it over to Nick, and between them, they've covered 250 articles, and Nick remains the current editor. But it was the vision of a single person who started this all, and that vision had far-reaching consequences, and it promotes the Institute both here and overseas. So congratulations, David, on starting this thing, which is of value to all of us. And I'd like to ask you to come up and accept a token of the Institute's appreciation for your work over the years.